Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri. In his latest book, Grieve's Passing, A Novel in Fugue, Vermont author Richard Hawley weaves together the stories of three members of the same family. John Grieve is the headmaster of Wells School, a private New England prep school. And Meg is his wife, diagnosed with terminal cancer at the beginning of the book. Their son, Brian Grieve, is a disaffected young adult who has cut ties while he's traveling abroad, finding himself. Grieve's Passing weaves their three stories together through journal entries and letters written by the three characters themselves. Fans of Hawley's work may recognize these names. His bestseller from the 1980s, The Headmaster's Papers, told the story of John Grieve. And The Headmaster's Wife, Hawley's follow-up, told Meg's. Vermont Edition's Jane Lindholm spoke to Hawley earlier this month. The author says that over the past 30 years, he came to the realization that he was still living with these characters, and he needed to tell Brian's story, too.
I thought I was kind of telling it when, years ago, I published the first of these volumes, The Headmaster's Papers. And for a decade after, I couldn't get his wife's story, Meg's story, out of my head. And as a writer, I found that those things that don't go away are the things that you actually write. So I composed that novel in I think, 2000. It made, in my mind, kind of a happy compliment to the story of John Grieve, the headmaster, in the original book. But then, just as happened with Meg, I couldn't get their son's story out of my mind. I actually wanted to. I wanted it to go away. But it just seemed like it was such an incomplete open question in his mother's and father's lives that I just really powerfully felt I had to write it. And I wrote it very quickly. And it seemed to complete the story and answer the mother's and father's questions.
I'm interested that you said you were hoping to get this family out of your head, or to get Brian out of your head, and not to have to write his story in his own words. Because, you know, I have to admit, this is a depressing family to be a part of. And so I can't imagine being a part of this family and this story for 30 years, because you have John Grieve, who's really mourning his wife's terminal diagnosis. You have Meg, who knows she's going to die. And then now you have the story of Brian, who's off in Europe, finding himself maybe, but he's not having a great time either.
Not having a great time, but he's having a thoughtful time. I would like to consider the word depressing for a minute. All three characters, in different ways and for different reasons, are in extremis, and each one of them has to actually confront his and her mortality. But my feeling as a reader, and also as a writer, is that when you're confronting your mortality, you see things more vividly than you otherwise ever could. You know, people talk about deathbed experiences. Would you do more or less of that on your deathbed and so forth? They're not all on their deathbeds, but they're all facing big existential crises. And my feeling was, in that condition, that's when you see most truly. That's when you experience things most vividly, become your most authentic self. And that's what I was trying to achieve in this so-called novel in fugue, where I wove their stories together. It wasn't to depress people with the idea, oh, you know, terminal things happen to people, but to show how brightly they could experience things from that condition.
What do you think it is about you that you've lived with this family and this story and can't seem to shake it?
That's really an interesting question, and I'm probably not maybe a psychiatrist. I might not be the best person to answer.
Right.
Because, I mean, all my writer friends all start from a number of different perspectives, and some have very clear, you know, what the architecture of their work and what they're going to do. Mine tends to come out of me whole. The first person I wrote about in this series was John Grieve, the headmaster of the Wells School that you described, and I don't really know where that came from. I became a headmaster later in life, I think because God's an ironist. But I was not a headmaster when I wrote this. I was very interested in schools, and I'd done a lot of reading about independent schools, both here in Britain. But this character came fully into my life. I felt I could walk in his closet and see what was hanging there.
I don't want to suggest that you've just been sitting in your study for 30-plus years inside your head, living with the Grieve's family. You've written many other works. You've written poetry. You've written nonfiction books, especially about boys and education, which we've interviewed you on before. So I certainly don't mean to give the impression that you have this inability to focus on any other story, but it's interesting that it has so captivated you for so many years.
And it is really true as a writer. I mean, I've had a lot of projects, fictions I wanted to do. I've had nonfiction things, as you say. I'm very interested in the nature of boys and how boys are doing doing and things that might improve their engagement in school and so forth. And so I've got enough things on my plate. And also, not to mention, I was a headmaster of a school and I was teaching courses and advising.
It takes a little bit of time.
Yeah, I had a day job. But sometimes, I mean, an impulse to write a poem or something, it comes up and it would go away and I'd be glad I didn't have to do that. But the ones that don't go away are the ones that get transcribed. And that's – and both – well, all three characters, but especially Meg, I just remember feeling the longer I spent not writing her story, the better I felt I knew her. I really liked her as well, and that was a kind of a fascinating thing.
You know, one of the things that struck me, though, in reading this version where you've combined all three stories and added the story of Brian is that it is so set in one place in time because technology has moved on since you started this story. So you published the headmaster's papers in 1983, right?
Right.
And so the story is set in the 80s and it's letters that John Greaves is writing to various people about the school and about his life and letters he writes to his son and then leaves or mails to post offices in Europe where he thinks Brian might be. But he can't reach his son, can't tell his son that his mother has cancer and is dying. And that would be so different now in the era of email where you don't have to find a post office and hope that your child is there to pick up the letter. Could you have even written Brian's story the same way if you were trying to set it today?
Not the same way. You're absolutely right. This is set because it was conceived in the era before cell phones, before email, before and almost before zip codes. I mean, it was you're touching on something that also is a I think a theme I hope running through this book is that not only is it transcribed about a prior age, as you say, probably some putative late 70s, 80s. It's about, in a big way, a prior time. The values mm-hmm. that John Greve has and that Meg has and that Brian, although he struggles with them, is trying to incorporate into his life, could well be passing values. You know, that they could be values embedded in what used to be called Western civilization, which, as you know, was being challenged mightily at that time and more so since. And so I thought it was very important. I wanted to write a novel in an age when letters were still a sort of a medium of understanding people. I also personally loved reading letters, writers' letters, historical figures' letters, and so forth. I was just given Nabokov's letters to his wife Vera for Christmas. Totally lost in it. So I wanted to evoke a just slightly prior world. And you're right. I think you could tell this kind of story, this family, which is actually a loving family, although they're mm-hmm. in some ways estranged. I mean, they are deeply engaged in each other's lives, even though far apart. I think such families still exist with the same kind of complexities, but you could not do it this way. I wanted there to be a real distance, unfindable distance. Brian is abroad. He's in Portugal and southern Spain, and then at the very end in Morocco on the Atlantic coast.
You know, it's interesting when you say you think they're passing values. I mean, I see an upper middle class white liberal family, which doesn't seem like something that's endangered at the moment. But you think the values that are expressed in this family sort of in their time are dying off?
Yes. I mean, certainly white upper class life goes on and perhaps a more gated, privileged way than ever. But the values I'm talking about are not necessarily to do with money class. They're to do with what John Greve, for instance, in the first novel, hope would be sort of understood concepts of fairness and justice and quality. And, you know, he was a little bit of an anachronism in his school. I mean, there was no television. There were no electronic. Had there been phones, they would not have been allowed. You know, it was very steeped in sort of the Western tradition of values and sort of almost a muted but still strong Judeo-Christian tradition. I think John's most feeling utterances from his podium in his school are about the meaning of Christmas and Easter mm-hmm. and loss and far from being sort of a privileged life in terms of having things, it's actually these are values that are more Spartan. I mean, worried about the danger of having things. It's a very anti-commercial culture value set, you know, although, as you say, they're in some ways privileged people. They're white, moderately affluent. I mean, they're not hurting, but they've been people actually for whom money, having enough, has actually been an issue in their lives at various times.
So, Rick, is this it? Are we going to find some illegitimate child of John Grieve pop up for another book, or are you released now?
I can absolutely promise you that you are released from all Grieves and their passing. And now,
but are you? Does this feel different in your soul?
It actually feels complete. I mean, it feels as I also said in that afterword that you mentioned. Not all the characters, not all the readers of these books like all of the characters. I have this wonderful fortune for 20 some years after it was published. There's a wonderful man named David Mallory who does independent school work. He does, in effect, sort of growth seminars for school leaders and so forth. Anyways, he would have these conferences of headmasters, 20, 30, 40, 50 of them at a time in Philadelphia, and invite me to come and spend a long evening and talk about this book with them, headmaster's papers with them. And so I was not even a headmaster at the time that I wrote it. And so I had 20-some years of feedback of what these real people doing the real work, how they responded to it. And some of them thought he was a martyred hero, and some of them thought he was a hidebound, you know, conservative who should have been warmer and listened to people in different ways. So it was wonderful actually to hear, you know, what these various people thought. From my point of view, I now realize that, you know, my authorial view, you know, there's a concept in criticism called the intentionalist fallacy, where what the writer intends is not necessarily what the book says. And I've learned that in my bones, that there have been so many readings of this. But my reading of it finally is, yes, to answer your question, it feels complete. And even after writing it, I don't think I've ever liked The Three Principles more, you know, than since I've completed it.
Well, they are in their various ways very likable characters, and it was a pleasure to spend time with all three of them. The book is called Grieve's Passing, A Novel in Fugue. It's by Richard Hawley. Rick, thanks for talking with us.
Jane, thank you very much.